Welcome to the Senate Committee on Education and General Government. Senator Cruz is frantically trying to turn off his cell phone. He doesn't want to have to pay the common school fund. So I will remind all of you to turn off your PDA cell phones, anything that makes noise, please. We have a couple of bills on the docket, and we also have a status report on School for the Blind and School for the Deaf. And we have an interpreter here for the special schools. And I need to know, is there anyone in the room who needs the services of an interpreter? If not, I will discharge the interpreter and we will do the bills first. So is there anyone here who needs assistance with hearing? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone. So thank you for turning out today. I appreciate it. And your first name?
Chris.
And your last name?
Keene.
Chris Keene. We've had you in here before. Yeah, and I appreciate that you come out and do a great job.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, so because we don't need interpreters and we've got some, two of our members are in Senate Revenue, and if we could get them on earlier rather than later, they would appreciate it because they've got some big bills up. So we're going to do these two bills first, and then we'll do the informational hearing on School for the Deaf and School for the Blind. So are you going to holler for those guys? Okay, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3606A, and I we'll have Ms. Richardson explain it first, and then she'll go retrieve our members.
Madam Chair, I was specifically House Bill 3605 that one of the members had questions on.
Oh, so do you want me to do that one first? Then we will close a public hearing on 3606A, open a public hearing on 3605A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3605A permits the Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services, in conjunction with the Governor's Declaration of Emergency, to issue an executive order to suspend or extend certain requirements of law and provisions of insurance policies and contracts. Provides for extensions of such an order, it directs the Department to adopt rules to establish criteria for such orders, and allows adoption of rules applicable to specific disaster declarations. It declares emergency and is effective upon passage.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Richardson. We're awaiting our list. 3605. Thank you very much. Okay, well, not a lot of folks. Scott Kipper, you're the only one signed up to testify. That tells me that everybody's happy.
Happy.
Madam Chair, if we could wait just a minute before he begins his testimony until Senator Morse gets here.
Okay, we can do that.
And we do not necessarily have opposition to the bill. We just need an explanation of why we need it.
Madam Chair, he gave me the indication that we could proceed.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Mr. Kipper, do you want to introduce yourself and take it away?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Kipper. I'm the administrator of the Division of Insurance for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I am here today to discuss the provisions and outcomes of the DCBS emergency order that was issued following the winter storms of December 2007, as well as discuss some of the provisions of the bill you have in front of you. Immediately following the storm, DCBS and the insurance division division personnel began outreach efforts to assist Oregonians in the affected areas following the December 2007 storms. We posted information on our websites and provided information to consumers on the federal flood insurance program and on homeowners insurance coverage. We also sent division personnel to the impacted areas and staffed official disaster recovery centers, 4 days each in Vernonia and Seaside, and 3 days in Tillamook. And Madam Chair, I would also like to share with you that we had personnel in Vernonia last week attending a national flood insurance program training and also spent time with consumers who had questions last week. In addition to staffing these information booths, we did distribute signs and literature at the St. Helens and Astoria Disaster Recovery Centers. Personnel within the division worked intimately with FEMA, the FEMA coordinator for Oregon, to make sure that adequate resources were made available to help consumers with their insurance questions, and also have established a liaison with the National Flood Insurance Program for assistance. The Department of Consumer and Business Services did implement an emergency order dated on December 7th, 2007. The order suspended certain rules and statutes based on the state of emergency. It created an extension of grace period provisions and policy reinstatement timeframes, limited cancellations and non-renewal actions by insurers, and addressed claim payment provisions. These rules were created in response to the issuance of Executive Order 07-24 by Governor Kulongoski and were issued pursuant to the authority delegated to the governor by the governor to the director of DCBS. Specifically, the emergency rule postponed the requirement for consumers to submit premiums for insurance coverage, and that postponement went until January 3, 2008. The extension of this time to consumers did not relieve any obligation for the payment of any premiums. It simply postponed that obligation. There were a number of other provisions that were included in the emergency rule. Insurers, by the most part, were extremely cooperative and compliant with the emergency order. The division did field many questions and inquiries from insurers so as to make sure that the carriers were in full compliance. And, in fact, the Division of Insurance did place a brief note on its website publicly thanking the efforts of the insurance industry in cooperation and assisting the consumers of Oregon. To date, the number of complaints have been and remain steady, and there have been no complaints alleging abuse, ignorance, or noncompliance of the emergency rule. Now, in performing a post-emergency rule review, the division has identified a handful of issues that, if given the opportunity and the time and clarity of hindsight, we would have addressed differently. For instance, the offset of the amount of a claim against the premium might work well for a personal lines claim, in other words, on your homeowner's or your automobile claim, but would not work as well for a health insurance claim, where the payee of the claim may be a third party, such as a physician or a hospital. The bill before you today would memorialize in statute many of the provisions set forth in the emergency rule. As amended, this bill would require the department to create rules that could be utilized to protect consumers in the event of another catastrophe. The rulemaking process, as set forth in this statute, would be done well in advance of the next catastrophe and would allow the input of consumers and insurers to make sure that all points of view are taken into consideration. Amendments to the original bill were crafted by DCBS personnel and members of the insurance industry at the direction of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. The amendments were developed to create more specificity as to what issues the rules would address. The development and adoption of these rules will allow the insurance industry to prepare contingency plans with greater specificity to address concerns after the next catastrophe. And with that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I conclude my remarks and will be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Senator Cruz, you act like you're...
Thank you, Madam Chair. To simplify this... I'm obviously there's layers and layers, there usually is, but the biggest gist of what you did was to basically say emergency hits and you won't be canceled because you haven't paid a premium and everything stays in place until the world kind of settles back down again. So... I mean, that's basically the gist of what you're after here, I'm assuming.
Senator Cruz and Madam Chairman, that is correct, that the emergency rules did provide basically a time buffer for consumers to essentially get their insurance world back in order, make sure that the one less concern that they may have, that they would not be canceled because they were in the process of rebuilding their homes and rebuilding their lives.
Mr. Cooper, this is a little bit like the unconscionable pricing bill that it took a while to get that through. I remember working on that in 99 or 2001, and when I was in the House, and we finally got that passed last session. So, in a sense, it's like this: it does, as Senator Cruz says, just sort of stops time and says you can't cancel or increase premiums during this period of time. Correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right, Senator Metzger, do you have any questions?
Nope.
I think this is good work that the House committee has done on this bill, and I see Representative Witt is here to testify, and so I'll have him come up and give us a little bit more information, but I appreciate it. Mr. Kipper, your testimony has been wonderful.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31. I and my adjoining House District, which Debbie Boone represents, and which pretty much defines Senator Johnson's Senate District, was that portion of our state which was hit most dramatically in the December storms. And in the wake of virtual destruction of at least one town and parts of many, many others, a series of three bills came out of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee, of which House Bill 3605 is one, 06 and 07 the other two. As Mr. Kipper just described, this bill is an effort to develop some protocols that would exist in the event that a declared natural disaster came into play. In the December storm, folks were faced with because of flooding, mudslides, et cetera, were faced first with an inability to receive an insurance bill. Their mailboxes may well have been under 10 feet of mud, as was the case in Woodson. Many folks were unable to go to work, either cut off or their employer was operations were out of commission or a whole host of other reasons. Their houses may have been underwater, may have been destroyed, et cetera, et cetera. Folks were on the verge of losing insurance policies because of this situation, and the governor, of course, declared an emergency and, in essence, did a temporary stay for insurance payments for 1 month. That was the avenue that was available to us at the time, and it was the right thing to do, but quite frankly, with the benefit now of not being faced with an impending disaster, I think we can do a much better job than we did, and anticipate perhaps some of the exigencies, some of the unintended consequences and whatnot of these kinds of actions. That's why this bill is intended to be the development of rules through DCBS so that those protocols can be developed. And the next time we face a natural disaster, we can pull those off of the shelf, and whichever one's portions of those protocols are most applicable to any given situation, then implement those. Initially, this bill was intended to be a legislative fix, and I was convinced by the insurance industry that with the benefit of more time, the benefit of more public input from all the interested parties, that the process would be much better at the end. One of the examples that was given to me being and which convinced me that the rules making process was a better way to go was the example where someone had obtained an insurance policy. The law potentially would have said that policy could not be canceled in the wake of a natural disaster. And the what if was, what if as an insurance investigator I go out and I determine that an insurance policy was obtained fraudulently, And I still can't cancel the insurance policy because the statute would have prohibited this. With the benefit, as I say, of a rules-making process, I think that we can come out with a product that will be fair to everyone. We'll anticipate all the potential scenarios, and everyone, I think, could be satisfied with the end product. And in this instance, I'm very pleased to be able to tell you that while I do not speak for the insurance industry, they have been very supportive, have done an extremely good job in my district, and have made sure to the greatest extent possible that folks that have lost virtually everything in their lives has been taken care of as expeditiously as possible. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Representative Witt. The insurance industry is represented very healthily in the back of the room, and they are all very smiling.
Kind of, sort of.
And I've been told they have no objections to the bill. And you know, this is a reason why in 2005 I passed a bill that says insurance companies cannot cancel you by email.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an example. If you're flooded or your house burns down or just a simple fact that your computer doesn't get your email, you can't be canceled by email. And so they have to send written notice if you have agreed to interact with your insurance company by email, but they've not been able to get a response from you. So I'm glad to see this is a further extension of that sort of thing. And I'm also glad, Representative Witt, I read in the paper where FEMA, as I believe they're in Vernonia now, helping remap the community for flood protection in the future. Am I correct about that?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And if I can diverge here just for mm-hmm. a moment. With the benefit of the new mapping, the community has been able to determine that much of their land, which was actually mapped in a 500-year floodplain, is actually probably 100 years, possibly even less. With these up-to-date maps, the discussion that's going on now in the community is how and where do we move our community? And what do we do with the land that is now part of the public's infrastructure? The discussion is a creation of a greenway in the downtown area, where there may be golf courses, there may be public parks, there may be a series of items, things where if it were to flood again with any kind of regularity. The flooding, of course, could be taken care of with relative ease rather than flooding someone's home or a public building. We're talking about flooding a public park, which presumably could be fairly readily cleaned up. In the wake of the disaster, having gone there, I can tell you that it was perhaps easy for us who are outsiders to come in and say, you know, you have to move your home. The public cannot continue to pay insurance, support payments, all of these kinds of things. But I have to tell you, if it were my home, it would be a difficult decision. But my hat is off to that community because that is the very discussion that they're having right now, mm-hmm. moving homes and moving the public's infrastructure to higher ground and recreating what potentially could be a model example of a planned community. So even out of disaster, potentially, good things can happen.
Well, my in-laws are both graduates of Vernonia High School. My father-in-law's passed away a few years ago, but my husband's grandparents lived there for over 50 years, and they got flooded many times. They lived down by the old mill pond, uh-huh. which I think is now called Vernonia Lake.
Yes.
But it was the old mill pond then, and they got flooded several times, and their house was built up. And so I'm glad to see that we're taking this proactive approach, and you're right, it's very hard to look at where your home has been for generations and have to move it. So I appreciate that you have been there helping helping your community, Representative Witt. I know you do an excellent job. You're very caring and compassionate. And I think this is a nice fix potential for any potential hanky-panky that goes on out there. And what I really appreciate hearing from you is that there was very little disagreement with the insurance community, because I don't think they're out to stiff people. I think they're out to help people and help us make good decisions. So I'm really glad that you worked it all out. And I don't see 3607. I see we have 3606.
That's in the ways and means, Madam Chair.
Okay, that's why we don't have it here.
Correct.
Okay, great. Any questions? Are you satisfied?
I think so. Maybe we ought to send some of the folks from Vernonia to New Orleans. To talk about relocation.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, quite frankly, repeatedly, I cannot count on both hands the number of times that the folks from FEMA commented what a fantastic job first the state of Oregon did, and secondly what the community of Vernonia did, and ran along the lines that folks didn't wait for the federal government to come in and in essence bail people out. The community got together, took direct action, and now are waiting on FEMA to help pay for the costs. So that's the way presumably I think we'd all hope that it took place.
Well, and I think we learned from New Orleans.
Well, but that's the characteristic way rural Oregon operates, so
that's exactly right, too.
I think you're right.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Witt. I think what we're going to do is close the public hearing. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify, and then I'll hear the other bill, and then we'll retrieve our two members and then vote them both out at the same time.
Thank you.
Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3605, open a public hearing again on House Bill 3606.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3606 authorizes the governor to waive the one-week waiting period for payment of unemployment insurance benefits following the declaration of an emergency to individuals residing within the affected areas. It makes this authorization contingent upon federal law allowing a waiver without penalty.
Okay. Tom Byerly and Representative Witt again. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Byerly. I'm Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. Here to answer any questions you have on House Bill 3606A. This bill came from the House Interim Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. Worked real closely with the committee and Representative Witt. This bill came out of another response to some of the events from the December storm, where many people were left out of work when the companies they worked for had to close down for a number of reasons resulting from the storm, either to just clean up or to get their business, rebuild their buildings or what have you. And others that did not qualify for regular unemployment insurance were eligible for disaster unemployment assistance. It's a federal program that is funded by FEMA, the federal government. And because of the date that the disaster was declared by the governor, those that were able to claim the disaster unemployment assistance were able to get benefits immediately, whereas those that filed for regular unemployment insurance benefits were required to serve the statutorily required waiting week. So we were working with the governor's office and Representative Witt's committee. We're looking at ways to see if we could waive the waiting week. And if you look at Section 4 of the amended bill, it basically outlines that this authority will come into play when federal law, changes to allow waiver without a penalty. What happens now under the Federal Unemployment Tax Act is that if a state waives the waiting week and then later the unemployment level rises to a point where you, quote, trigger on, unquote, to a benefit extension that's paid partially by the feds and partially by the state, 50-50, then the feds will not reimburse the state for that first week of that extension. And for Oregon employers, that means a $10.4 million fiscal impact if we do that.
A $10.4 million fiscal if you paid out how much money?
If you paid out one claim.
Just one claim.
Yeah.
And they hit you. How do they determine the...
Well, it's in the reimbursement scheme in federal law.
I see. $10.4 million?
Behind the scenes, we've been working also with our congressional delegation, and I sent a white paper to Senator Wyden's office explaining why Oregon is penalized if we waive the waiting week. Because many people have asked me, gosh, the state of California waived the waiting week and the fires and some of the farming freezes. Why can't Oregon? The state of California's economy has always been robust enough that they never trigger onto the extended benefits. Whereas Oregon, where we're natural resource-based for much of our work, we have very seasonal unemployment. And as many of you know, you've been in the legislature for quite a while, many recessions. And so we go into lots of extensions. So where California can get away with it, we can't. The state of Washington has a similar bill in their legislature right now because they have the same problem. If they waive the waiting week, they're facing a $15.4 million fiscal impact to employers.
Thanks.
So, again, we are pursuing congressional legislation, but in the interim, we wanted to get this bill passed so we're ready if federal law changes and we have another disaster, the governor will have that authority. Probably rambled on and gave you more information than you're looking for, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah. Does it take a change of law, or is there some sort of waiver process that could also deal with this?
The federal law requires that the governor have statutory authority,
right,
specifically to waive the waiting week, and that's why we're doing
it. Well, I know, but then we still face a penalty if he waives. I mean, you said it has to be a change in federal law.
Correct.
To indemnify us in this case. So this isn't something that, I mean, with in DHS, a lot of programs where federal money's coming in, we can get waivers to do different things, but this isn't a waivable thing. It's got to be a change in law itself.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, that's true. It has to have a law change. We could not apply for a waiver. They wouldn't allow it.
Okay.
And so, Mr. Byerly, we are doing this in anticipation of hopefully getting the federal government to change the rules sometime, hopefully, between now and
the next disaster.
Rather than, I mean, if we waited until 2009 to do this and the federal government decided to waive the rule like in June, we couldn't do this because we haven't passed this bill, correct?
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. And we could have a disaster. We could have a fire. That's a disaster. Well, and we still could have floods because if it stays warm and the snow melts.
Madam Chair, the Director of Office of Emergency Management sends us weather reports weekly about the possible flooding from the snowpack, and so we're standing by.
Yeah, I'm very worried about that. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in favor of House Bill 3606A engrossed. In its original form, this bill had intended to, in essence, retroactively pay benefits for the folks that were adversely impacted by the storm. There were, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 450 individuals, a little less than that. But because, as Mr. Barley pointed out, we faced a $10 million penalty if we did that, the bill was amended so that it is prospective in nature. I think this is another example of having gone through a devastating natural disaster and looking at what worked and what didn't. This is an area where we can make things work better in the future. And we in state government, along with our federal partners, are in the process right now of attempting to make this better for folks in the future. It will not benefit my constituents who were wiped out in this last disaster. But we can make it better for folks in the future. If you the typical unemployment claimant has lost a job one way or another. A disaster, I hesitate to use the word victim. None of them want to be called victims, I can assure you that.
We'll call them a survivor.
Yeah. The survivors in this instance have lost a job because they've lost a whole lot more than just the job. That's why they're unemployed. They've lost a home. They've perhaps lost the place of employment. In the December storm, there were mudslides that shut down Highway 30, cut off transportation, cut off the ability for people to commute, in addition to folks having lost their homes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In view of kind of the double jeopardy, to the extent that we could waive that 1 week waiting period in the future, I think would enable some folks who have been literally wiped out to at least maintain some semblance of income support during an exceedingly difficult time. So that, in a nutshell, is are the reasons behind this bill, and we certainly hope that your committee could be supportive. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Pleased that you were able to find these bills that we could help with this disaster and in the future. It's forward thinking, and I appreciate that. Any questions in the committee? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We've got our committee members, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3606A and open a work session on House Bill 3606A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3606 engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3606A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, great. Would you like to call the roll, please?
Senator
Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Mendoza?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3606A passes to the floor of the Senate. Let's see. Senator Metzger, do you want to carry this one?
Sure.
Okay. And then I will close the work session on House Bill 3606A, open a work session on House Bill 3605A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3605A engrossed to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3605A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I'm sorry you guys missed out on the conversation about this.
Yeah,
you heard all about...
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, our questions were answered.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll trust my colleagues on this one, but I'll reserve the right to make...
I will inform you. I will inform you later
okay.
on.
Okay.
Yes, he will.
Thank you, but I do appreciate the opportunity to come and vote, as does I'm sure.
We did. We heard some very compelling testimony about the work in Vernonia and Representative Witt's work on these two bills. So I think you'll be pleased. All right. Hearing no further discussion, would you call the roll, please?
Senator
Hatch?
Aye.
Senator
Metzger?
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3605A goes to the floor of the Senate. And Senator Cruz, I'm going to assign that to you so that you can inform Senator Morse. Close the work session on House Bill 3605A. Thank you, gentlemen. If you have to go back to committee, you can do that. We will open a public hearing on the status of the possible consolidation of the campuses for the Oregon School for the Deaf and the Oregon School for the Blind. And I think I have testimony here. So let's see. We will hear from the department first so they can tell us where we're at. And I want to finish up with Neil Clyver and Don Dorman from the special school so you can tell us about what's been going on there and what you might need our help with. So I'd like to do it that way. So let's start out with Nancy Latini and Sue McLashlin, and then I think we have Adrian Sexton and Jan Lane, do we not? So whoever of you four wants to come up first, we'll do two and two. Or three and one. I don't really care. Three and two? All right.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sue McLashlin, Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Finance and Administration at the Oregon Department of Education. And with me today is Nancy Latini, Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, also at the department. And I'd also like to introduce Bruce Murray. And Mr. Murray is a former Executive Vice President with Bank of America and a former Real Estate Director of for Chicago Public Schools. And he served on a site panel that was convened at our request by Innovation Partnership to examine the consolidation issue. And we're here today to provide you with an update on a budget note from the 2007 legislative session, which directed the department to do further analysis on the viability of co-locating the two schools on the campus for the School for the Deaf. And there are essentially two components to the budget note. One relates to our issuing an RFP, or a request for proposal, for the cost of the needed changes to the OSD campus to accommodate the OSB population. And the other component relates to discussions with potential buyers of the OSB property. And as we reported to Ways and Means, the agency has been working primarily on the portion of the budget note related to developing the RFP for the legislature's review. And our focus so far pretty much has been on gathering information to ensure a successful RFP process. So just briefly, I'll touch on what we've done in terms of gathering that information. We've collected information from service providers regarding needed services for the blind and visually impaired in order to guide program design and delivery structure on a co-located campus. We've received input from a panel of school and other real estate experts regarding the current utilization of the sites, the potential for co-location, the changes that would be needed to accommodate both student populations, and recommendations for a development process. To further inform the process, we've engaged the audits division to do a risk assessment at both schools in a variety of areas, including campus safety, meeting student needs, and managing the co-location process. And we expect to receive their report in the near future. And we've also asked the Oregon State Police to conduct a safety assessment. And as we informed Ways and Means, the RFP has not yet been developed. We thought that would be premature, given the site panel's recommendation to proceed first with what they are calling a request for quotation, or RFQ, process. And what I'd like to do now is turn the mic over to Mr. Murray so that he can provide you with more detail on the site panel's work and recommendations. And with your permission, I'd like to provide you with an update that we provided to Ways and Means Committee last Thursday at its request.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Murray?
As I said, my name is Bruce Murray, and as a volunteer, I serve as the chairman of the site panel committee of the Center for Innovative School Facilities. We were engaged to examine the consolidation of both programs onto one campus, the impact on facilities and site plan issues, the appraisal of the OSB site and other value funding issues, and to make recommendations for a future development process. What I thought I'd do is just share, you know, some of our conclusions from our executive summary. And these are: if one accepts the assumption that the residential school model is retained for approximately today's student population, the panel concurs with the relocation of the Oregon School for the Blind facilities to the Oregon School for the Deaf campus. This would allow optimal shared use, optimal savings, and the rehabilitation and use of existing buildings. Regarding the utilization of specific buildings, the need for new construction, and the design of a new campus, we toured both sites and reviewed the OTAC report dated February 2007 and offered specific comments as outlined in our report regarding the utilization of specific buildings. And I'll skip over those just for, you know, the saving of time now. The panel believes that the cost above of this work may well be less than the OTAC estimate, given the decreased reliance on new construction and given the likely efficiencies and creativity of a developer-led design and construction process. Regarding certain value issues, the panel believes that the sale of the School for the Blind site may realize perhaps 1.5 to 2 times the January 2007 appraisal. While the appraisal certainly was properly done, the large size of the site and its proximity to two expanding institutional users may argue for upward adjustments to the comparables, not downward. A carefully managed developer-led process should maximize the sales proceeds. The panel also recommends that a model be developed which includes all the costs incidental to relocation of the facilities. The panel also stated that the consolidation of the two campuses should result in significant operating cost savings. The panel believes that it is reasonable for the Department of Education to request additional funds for the consolidation in an amount equal to 5 to 6 times these savings. This additional investment will facilitate operating efficiencies and be recovered in a short payback period. The panel believes that the funds available from the School for the Blind site from a reasonable multiple of the operating savings and from the sale of the residual excess land at the School for the Deaf site may well cover the total cost of the consolidation. In addition, the panel strongly believes that an experienced real estate developer needs to be selected through an RFQ process to lead and manage the consolidation process. A qualified developer can bring significant value by establishing a dialogue with all parties while managing and coordinating all consultants and contractors, finding solutions consistent with resources and objectives, and maximizing sales proceeds. So those are our principal conclusions from our site panel work that we shared with the Department of Education.
Mr. Murray, did you provide us with the written testimony you just read?
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Sue McGlashan, the committee members did get a copy of the full report from Innovation Partnership, okay. And that would have the executive summary in it.
I see. Okay. I see it right here. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Lucchini, are you next?
Nancy Lucchini, Department of Education. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm going to just briefly tell you about a survey that was conducted. Again, in no way a survey that's going to be an end-all to anything, but through some of the study groups that we had, people talked about what possibly were the service needs for students who were blind or visually impaired, and most of it was hearsay. There was nothing that was formalized. So some of our staff put together a Survey Monkey, and we had school district people, service providers, administrators, and teachers actually from the School for the Blind as well, respond to that in a short period of time. We had about 141 respondents. Unfortunately, there was a high percentage of these people who marked other, so we don't know if they were regional staff, teachers from the OSB, or administrators from school districts. But essentially, it was confirming some of the things that no matter what happens, we want to make sure that we're providing the needed services for our students who are blind and visually impaired. And what the districts were telling us was that the important services that they need from the School for the Blind for independent living skills, orientation and mobility, and technology. They felt that if students were able to manage in the general ed curriculum, they could manage that with regional support that they currently have and also adjusting the curriculum. When we asked them the question about what was difficult to provide at their school district, they essentially said independent living skills, career education and recreation, all those transition skills moving into adult living, and technology. So it's fairly consistent. And again, what they felt they could do is access to the general ed curriculum. We also asked questions about what was the challenge of placing students at the School for the Blind. And again, it were things that we had sort of guessed, but it was better to hear and actually see responses. The distance from home, the lack of weekend programs, and educating students in an environment away from their non-disabled peers. We asked them also about what should be the focus of OSB. If you had a choice, what would that be? And again, they talked about serving students at transition age, getting them ready for adulthood. And they also talked a little bit about indicating those students that have more than one disability and some of the challenges that they face there. They talked about the things that they would like to see expanded and better rolled out for them as far as options for kids were short-term placements where students would come in for a period of time to learn a specific set of skills and also some kind of like weekend topical seminars that may happen in the districts or at QNESD or at the School for the Blind, but somehow focusing on some specific skills. So those are, again, no way is the end-all of what we would be looking at because we certainly want to hear from parents and from students and from teachers on planning, but just in the overall types of services that we should be looking at that right now people had told us that they were looking at. So I'll give you that information.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Ms. McLaughlin, did you have anything else?
Madam Chair, thank you. I would just like to provide you with some concluding remarks. Again, for the record, Sue McLaughlin with the Oregon Department of Education. So at the February 6th meeting of the Ways and Means Committee, members had concerns and questions about several areas, including increasing construction costs over time and some members wanting to see this project, at least that was my impression, see this project move quickly, concerns about change orders, involvement of the Department of Administrative Services to help us, making sure we had appropriate program design, making sure we had adequate stakeholder input, and then just the timing and the cost of the project. And more specifically, what we heard was that Senator Schrader had two questions. When could the committee see the numbers, and when could we get the project done? And we were requested to come back with more information on February 14th. And what we did between February 6th and February 14th was meet with DAS facilities to seek their input. We met with some of their planning and construction folks in an effort to respond to the senator's questions. We were able to come up with a timeline, a possible timeline, I should say, for the project, and that's another document that we handed out for you today and was also handed out to the Ways and Means Committee. And I did point out to the Ways and Means Committee that this timeline, of course, is a rough estimate. It could be considered aggressive. And I also pointed out that the DAS timeline is not unlike that, not unlike the timeline from Innovation Partnership. And both of those are on that handout side by side. The first phase of the DAS timeline is shorter than the estimate from Innovation Partnership because we would not do the RFQ process. Basically, we would use DAS as the leader of the development team. But you can see in that handout that overall the duration of the project is pretty much the same. It's 2.5 to 3.5 years. I also informed the committee that should we go that route, there are some upfront costs associated with this. DAS gave us an estimate for phases 1 and 2, somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000, and that is not in our 2007-09 legislatively approved budget. The product from the first two phases would basically be a feasibility study that would provide a range of options, probably 3 to 5, that could then be presented to stakeholders. And then once an option is selected, we would get into the design phase and then finally the construction phase. Madam Chair and members, that concludes my remarks, and thank you. We'd be happy to answer any other questions you have.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. I know that when we passed the bill setting up the boards of directors for the two schools, we gave the boards the opportunity to appeal any decisions on co-location and siting of the schools. Has an appeal been lodged?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, not to my knowledge.
Okay. I'll ask the folks here who are testifying from the board then. Okay, any other questions from the committee? So you made your second presentation on the 14th, and is there another expectation of making a presentation to Ways and Means anytime soon?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, not during this session. What we were instructed to do was to work, as the chair said, offline with LFO in trying to meet the direction in the budget note, which is to develop the RFP.
Okay. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Were those all the folks from your agency that were going to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair, we do have other staff here to speak to some other issues relative to this subject.
Okay, so let's hear from the other staff. I want to get all the staff done, and then we're going to hear from the real folks.
Good afternoon, Chair Walker, members of the committee. Once again, Morgan Allen, Department of Education. And Cindy Hutton and I can address the question you just asked, Ms. McLaughlin, regarding appeal rights. And right now, there's a letter being handed out that went to the chairs and the members of each respective board. It went out, I believe, on January 9th, discussing that issue. And the long and the short of it is that starting on page 2, I'll read from the top, quoting the letter. At this time, there is not a decision of the superintendent regarding the co-location of the schools that may be appealed to the state board. Although the superintendent did announce a proposed plan in May 2007, an important part of her plan was that the move would be contingent on the sale of the OSB property, generating sufficient funds to make needed changes on the OSD campus. A portion of this plan requires legislative action. The superintendent intends to have a bill ready for the 2009 legislative session that would allow the funds from the sale of OSB property to be used to improve the co-located programs on the OSD campus. And as the letter says, prior to introducing that legislation, the superintendent and the department would notify each board about that official decision once that bill is drafted. And at that time, they could appeal to the State Board of Education. So we'd be happy to answer any questions.
It looks like we're in a catch-22.
Madam Chair, I think that's a very astute observation. From the part of the Ways and Means process is essentially the agency was asked to develop an RFP, which we have now two outside experts, both the Department of Administrative Services and the other folks that were up here testifying on the report, essentially saying we need to have some sort of RFQ process. That would cost approximately $200,000 to $300,000, and as Ms. McGlashan stated, that's not within our legislatively approved budget. And we were not surprisingly informed by the Ways and Means Committee that that funding would not be forthcoming, given the current economic situation. So we're at somewhat of an impasse right now, Senator Walker.
I don't like that answer, and I not that you weren't forthright in your answer, Mr. Allen, at all. It's just I don't like this situation. This isn't what I intended when I drafted that bill, and I have some real concerns here. That you can say that no decision has been made by the superintendent because a decision has been made. So I have concerns. Ms. Hunt,
yeah.
You helped me draft the bill.
Yeah.
So
Chair Walker,
talk
let
to
me
you
address
about
that. Yeah. Is that the bill basically had two appeals provisions in it. One was if the decision had been made after January 1st of 2007 and prior to the creation of the boards, then they had 60 days after the first meeting that they had. And at the first meeting, I went to the boards and explained their rights and also their duties under the bill and that kind of thing and answered any questions. But at that point, the superintendent had not made a decision that they could appeal, but there was questions. So this was a follow-up on that. And because we very much want those boards to be very involved in this, and so this will give them an opportunity this year, if the superintendent proceeds in front of the legislature, to be able to appeal that decision to the State Board of Education. And it lays out the process that they can do that. Because part of their questions was, how do we do this, basically? And so this also laid that out for them pretty clearly.
The problem is that yeah. We wait until we're so far along in the process. How on earth would the State Board of Education ever agree to second guess the superintendent's decision? I don't know that you can answer that.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, Senator Walker, I would like to remind the committee that the original genesis of this whole co-location issue was a budget note by the Ways and Means Committee during mm-hmm. the 2005 legislative session, and the department did its due diligence to carry that out, and there was a lot of discussion about this last session, which I don't think we need to rehash. But I think, again, at this point, we have been directed by the co-chairs of Ways and Means to continue to work with the legislative fiscal staff offline, and I think it's sort of indeterminate where that process will lead us on finalization of the budget note that we received in 2007 and ultimately what, if any, legislation comes forward during the 2009 legislative session.
I don't have my bill file with me, but my recollection is that we got a letter and a press release from the Department of Education from the superintendent saying that she'd made a decision to co-locate the school. So now are you telling me that was not a decision? That was just a thought?
Well, Chair Walker, I'll take a first stab at that, and I think Cindy can kick in and correct me. I believe that our interpretation of that is that that was a recommendation that required legislative action. So no decision or no action has been officially taken by the department to co-locate the schools, and the legislature has not authorized the department to use any proceeds from the sale of the school to relocate the school. So in essence, our interpretation is that's a recommendation and not a decision that is appealable under the bill.
I mean, aside from the budget note, there's two primary hindrances, I guess, to the superintendent proceeding under the statute to co-locate. The first is that there's an expenditure limitation in the department's budget that says that they can only expend a certain amount of money for the school, for the blind, school, for the deaf. That expenditure limitation is significantly lower than what it would cost to co-locate. And then the, I lost my train of thought there, totally. Anyway, so there's a couple of hindrances to the superintendent being able to proceed with this, even though under the statute she's directed to be able to do that. The legislature has put some limitations on that. So until the legislature lifts the expenditure limitation, or, oh, I just got the train of thought back, is that the sale of the school for the blind, if it was to be sold now, the money, the proceeds would go to DAS, and it would not go specifically to funding the new location. And so because of that, and that's a significant amount of money, it would be a significant amount of money to co-locate, that's also a hindrance. And that would also take legislative action.
But I think, Senator Walker, it would be fair to say, and you and I had some discussions about this when we were looking at various amendments around the boards. I mean, we don't have any intention of co-locating the schools unless there's funding there to make sure those facilities are upgraded and structured appropriately for the students there. I mean, the statute right now gives us the authority, literally, and Cindy can correct me if I'm wrong, we could load up the moving vans and announce that we're moving. The boards could appeal that. You know, we could set that all in motion, but there would be no funds for us to make sure those facilities were appropriately upgraded for those students. So, you know, we're sort of, you know, as you said, I guess maybe a good way to describe that is an impasse at this point.
Yeah. I remember the conversation we had, Ms. Hunt, in your office about that little issue about DAS getting the money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have any questions, Senator Cruz? We lost Senator Metzger. I think he had an appointment. Okay. If you'll just step back, I want to hear from the folks at the two schools.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Flyer and Mr. Dorman, can you come forward? And anyone else who wanted to testify? We've got three seats here. Okay, who would like to go first?
Chair Walker and members of the committee, my name is Neil Kleber.
I pronounced it incorrectly.
The spelling is K-L-I-E-W-E-R, but pronunciation isn't that way. And I am the chairperson of the newly formed Board of Directors of the School for the Blind. Now, the Oregon School for the Blind Board of Directors met for the first time October 31st, Halloween. And the board has met from 9 to 3, four times, October 31st, November 29th, January 10th, and February the 14th. And the first three meetings were conducted by the Department of Education, and they were informative meetings and telling us what our role would be, logistics, legislation that pertained to that, ethics, and Oregon administrative rules. The special education process was explained, including how school for blind students are enrolled and how they're retained and why and when they're transformed to the local school district. Don Wiemet, the School for the Blind director, took the board on a tour of the facilities, and as he was touring the facilities, explained the educational process and the residential program. At the end of the January 10th meeting, the third meeting, the board voted on a chair and a vice chair. And then the next meeting was on February the 14th. Valentine's Day, or Oregon's 149th birthday. We began working on the mandates as listed in Section 56 of House Bill 2263. Assisting us was Jane Lane, the newly appointed advisory board administrator. The board is comprised of a diverse group of individuals representing the blind community and the educational experiences and various other regions, in the various regions of Oregon, and I'd like to just mention who they are and what their role is. Claude Garvin is from Portland, and he is an OSB alumni, and he spent years working with the regional program and the Commission for the Blind. Janine Johnson is from Bend, and she is a regional teacher, and of course, a teacher of the visually impaired. Bradley Kimbrough, who goes by BT, is from Salem, and he represents business and is the executive director of Blind Skills, and Blind Skills produces an international magazine for the blind named Dialogue. Margot Lelich is from Cannon Beach, and she's a parent of an OSB student, also a registered nurse. Kay Seth represents the American Council for the Blind of Oregon, and she's immediate past president, and she's also an alumni of OSB. There are two organizations in Oregon that are made up of blind persons. They're representative of blind persons. And that's the Council of the Blind, which I just mentioned, and the other one is the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon, and the president of that is on the board, and that is Elizabeth Rosu Rooney, and she's from Cave Junction. And she's also vice chairman of the board of directors. And then myself, I'm representing the Commission for the Blind. I'm a commissioner on the Commission for the Blind, and am a retired past director of the School for the Blind. So the board we're working hard now. We've had one meeting on the master plan for the School for the Blind as directed in House Bill 2263, Section 56, Paragraph 1. And we're gathering information from the stakeholders and parents and students and the regional programs and school districts and a broad list of other Oregon citizens. Now, some of that information has been gathered by the Department of Education, as you just heard, and we're sifting through that. I understand that research has shown that public testimony is a better way than using questionnaires, so the board is considering having some arranging some time for public testimony. We're looking closely at the needs of Oregon's children who are visually impaired. Are their needs being met? Are there better ways of meeting their needs? And what changes are needed at the School for the Blind? We're contacting all of the schools for the blind in the nation to determine what students are being served, what are the national trends, and what are best practices. As chairperson, I'm really pleased with a variety of experiences and the depth of knowledge found in the members of the board. It has a diverse membership, which was required by House Bill 2263, and represents the education and blind communities, and also I would say that four of the members of the committee are blind. And in the 135-year history of the School for the Blind, this is the first time that the blind community has been given a voice in the operation of the school. We're concerned about the brief timeline for completing our work because I understand that with any legislative or budget proposals for the next legislative session, we would have to submit them to the Department of Education by April. That'll give us one more meeting. We wouldn't be able to complete this major undertaking in that short period of time. And because of this, we respectfully request that no major changes be made to the School for the Blind, such as the sale of the OSB property, until we have completed our legislative mandate to develop a master plan and submit that plan to the Superintendent of Public Instruction and the Legislative Assembly prior to February 1, 2009. And so I'd like to thank you for the opportunity of being able to tell us where we are. And we, of course, feel that we're just beginning, having had only one meeting in which we were in charge. And be happy to answer any questions that I am capable of.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Cleaver, because I'm so excited to hear about all the work you're doing. Of all the bills I passed last session and that this committee worked on, this is my favorite. because you're right, in the first, in the 135-year history of your school, you actually have a voice in how your school can be run, and I'm just so delighted about that.
And the blind community is so appreciative of your leadership and your work in getting this bill passed.
Yeah,
well, thank you.
It was no small feat, as Mr. Allen can tell you in the back of the room. The concern I have is that it took so long to get the boards appointed, which is why your timeline's been condensed here. And so I'm not sure what we're going to be able to do about that. After I hear from Mr. Dorman, then I want to hear from the department about this scrunch timeline and what that means. So I do appreciate you bringing that piece to our attention. And your board is running smoothly. You feel like you're all gelling and you're...
I feel really good about the board, and there's good rapport, and there's the experiences, and the quality of the board, I think Governor Kitzhaber did a great job in making the appointments. And it does represent all regions of the state. You know, often they're just in the valley, but it represents all regions of the state, and pretty well covers the blind community in all its ages and in its various aspects.
So. Well, that's great, and you're doing questionnaires, and I see here that you're considering taking public testimony, which I think is wonderful. I think this is great because it is a time to take a look at Oregon special schools, make sure that they're meeting our needs, particularly this is quite timely since they're looking at co-location.
Right.
And it's no secret that there are some members I serve with who would like to get rid of the schools altogether. So I appreciate that you're doing your homework and providing us with some information. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dorman, why don't you tell me about the Oregon School for the Deaf?
The Oregon School for the Deaf Board has met for two full days. The first one was in November. The second one was in January. We have elected a chairperson. His name is John Babbitt. He's a business owner from Southern Oregon who is also an alumni of OSD. Betsy Burke is the co-chair, and she represents regional programs. She's also a deaf individual from the Portland area. We have... as Neil said, a very, very broad-based board in that we have folks from all over the state. That's why Chairman John couldn't be here today. I am the representative for school districts and have also worked in regional programs and have also worked at the School for the Deaf and the School for the Blind. And again, the board is very appreciative of the opportunity to provide feedback into the school and have rolled up their sleeves. We've adopted our bylaws. We've just begun going through the documents that have been assembled by ODE in the past. We've been very appreciative of their help, kind of getting information to us quickly. And we are planning for the March meeting to do to begin with the mission statement. We're looking at mission statements from around the country, contacting other schools for the deaf, getting information about how they have prioritized their services in their states as the needs have changed over time. The concerns that have come up with our board, of course, are around the timelines, of course. There's an awful lot of information. As the Department of Education knows from the past, back when we were consolidating school districts, and as I'm finding out right now in my own school district, being a regular district employment now for a school, the decisions to move or to close schools are not just business decisions. They are, you talk to the people that have gone to the school in the past, the people who are living in the community there, the people who have children in that school. It's a process. It takes a lot of time, and one of the concerns that the board has risen, you've addressed, in that we were thinking that, well, the decision's made, but the decision's not made, and when exactly would we put in an appeal? when does the 60 days start? ODE did send us a letter trying to explain that no, officially a decision hasn't started. We still do have a lot of information to get together, though, as far as what programs need to be looked at. How would the programs be different? If we're having this or looking at this as an opportunity, then we need some time to do our work in saying, well, let's see how we can make this the best change possible. So that was a big concern from the board, and I know there's not an easy answer to that. But, you know, timelines are as they are for budgets and for committees and all that kind of stuff. All of us are working. You know, it's hard for us all to get together to do the work that we want to dig into. We're just hoping for the opportunity, though, for the boards to do some of the work. There's a lot of, let's just say repair to be done from last year, and we're hoping that the boards can be used in a positive way to help facilitate a positive change, and that is going to take a little bit of time. We're hoping that we also have the ability to put some input into the planning process. I think I'll just stop there, and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Gentlemen, how are your boards interacting with staff and students at the school? Are they utilizing you as a resource?
We haven't done too much in that area as of now, just because we haven't gotten, you know, we're so new. Mm-hmm. And the time's been taken up with training and education and, you know, just sitting at the tables.
It's just a steep learning curve, isn't it?
So we're, I would sure think we would get into that.
Mm-hmm. Have you had an opportunity, you toured the school.
We did tour the school.
So you had an opportunity to meet the staff and see some of the children.
Yeah, and we met many of the staff. And and we met children because we did tour programs. So we went into the classroom and talked to the teachers, and at the same time we were touring, they were explaining their programs to us.
Okay.
So that was helpful.
Okay. Mr. Dorman, you had the same experience?
All of us realized we were familiar with the school in one capacity or another, but we had scheduled a tour just to look at facilities and the age of the buildings and that kind of stuff, the kind of things that we weren't familiar with. Mm-hmm. We were so busy working on bylaws, we bumped that to our March meeting. So.
Well, yeah, you've only had two meetings, right?
Right?
So you're a little bit farther behind. And where you represent school districts, where are you from?
Currently, I'm working as the director for special ed and school improvement for Philomath School District, just outside of Corvallis.
Yeah. That's where my dog will have his final obedience class tonight at 6:30, and I will miss it yet again. There's a great dog trainer in Philomath.
Oh, I need one, actually.
I'll tell you about her. Wonder Dogs. Look her up. Okay, well, I want to hear from the department about the concerns about the timeline that you have here expressed here. And are there any other issues that you'd like us to hear about? Are you getting along with the department? Are they providing the resources that you would expect? Your new advisory person is Jane.
Jan
Lane.
J-A-N-N.
Okay.
L-A-N-E. Yes. The department has been very helpful to us in our first three meetings. I mean, they've presented us with a lot of information, a lot of good information, and so we really appreciated that.
So do you think we'll heal the rift that's sort of been created over the years?
Depends on what the outcome of
that. That's a good answer, Mr. Cleaver.
Whether the rift will be healed or not.
I think.
But I think the beginning of the healing of the rift would be allowing input by the blind. My understanding is that first committee at the Department of Education that really came up with this, and I might not myself be too knowledgeable, but I understand that committee did not have a blind or deaf person on it,
mm-hmm.
and that was a concern for me. Also, I attended, I believe, every hearing that the department held, and in my mind, there was an overwhelming feeling of against the collocation of the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually would like to see, I don't know if that this, any of that was compiled. I know I testified and I handed in written testimony, and I don't know if any of that was compiled, but that, if that's available, that would be a lot of information even for
mm-hmm.
the board.
Mm-hmm.
So we, mm-hmm. I could see us requesting that.
Okay, great. Well, I think I want to have Ms. Lane come up and Mr. Allen, because I'd like to meet Ms. Lane, and we can talk about that request you just made. So thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Senator Pleasure, do you have a question?
No,
okay. Should we post your artwork on the walls of the Capitol?
For the record, Morgan mm-hmm. Allen, Department of Education, Senator Walker, and the discussion about April timelines and June timelines, Ms. McGlashan, I might have to have her come up here and help me, but I believe on March 6th, the Department of Administrative Services will be sort of laying out the process for agencies to make budget recommendations to the governor's office. We'll certainly work with the boards as best we can, but we don't have a lot of control over those timelines. They are set by the Department of Administrative Services. Ms. McGlashan told me that, you know, it might be more like May or June, that they might have a little more time than they think. It might not be April, but again,
okay.
not much we can really do about that as an agency.
Okay, because you answer to another agency.
We do. And to the executive.
And that agency answers to the executive
That's
branch
correct.
For putting budgets together. Okay.
Correct. But the other deadlines in there, I believe, if my memory of the bill, sometime in February 09, I believe, the master plan and the reports to the legislature and both of the boards are invited to come before the Joint Ways and Means Committee, I believe, when we make our budget presentations, which
mm-hmm.
may be as early as February 09, but I think they may slip into March sometimes too as well. So,
okay. So we can get the master plan.
That may be up to the boards, but they have more time. As far as budgetary issues for the next biennium, the timelines are unfortunately a little bit compressed.
I think the question Mr. Cleaver raises, however, is that he doesn't want the department to make a decision about co-location since apparently the superintendent has not made a decision about co-location. She's only made a recommendation. He doesn't want that to take place before the master plan is completed. So can you give us an idea of when the superintendent is likely to make her recommendation final?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I think that will be dependent upon the result of the 2007 budget note that was in House Bill 1519 directing our agency to do, among other things, create an RFP. We've been before Ways and Means twice to report on that, and they have asked us to continue to work with their staff. So I think the outcome of that is yet to be determined. I will say this, that the superintendent and the department are committed to giving if and when a decision to co-locate or there's legislation or direction from the Ways and Means Committee or the department and the superintendent on their own initiative submit any legislation, we will certainly give the board an appropriate heads up and give them as much time as possible and inform mm-hmm. them of their rights, because we want to make sure they get before the state board and do that. So
well,
I can make that commitment.
Yeah, I would appreciate that, because I do think they need to be notified of their rights under the law. So. Okay. And you must be Ms. Lane.
Yes, I am. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm very happy to be here.
And you just need to restate your name for the record. It doesn't matter if I say it. But
it's Jan Lane,
okay.
for the record. And I am the new advisory board administrator and serving the board and getting the information that they will need to proceed with their legislative charge.
Okay. Ms. Lane, why don't you tell us a little bit of your background? You've just been hired recently.
Yes. It's been on the job for 1 week.
that is very recent.
That's very recent. I am a member of the Oregon State Bar. I began my career in education as an early childhood educator and eventually pursued a legal career. And in the meantime, while I was doing that, served on the Commission on Children and Families for the state of Oregon as well as Clackamas County, and became very involved in board work. And essentially when I saw this position, recognize that I like that kind of work and providing services to boards and making sure that people have the information they need to make appropriate decisions. And so I pursued this position.
Wow, you have some good credentials, and I know we struggle to find some applicants for the position, so I'm very happy that you happen to be there at the right time.
I am too.
Great. Well, so 1 week on the job, have you had a chance to meet both the boards yet at this point? Probably not.
Excuse me. We have had one meeting. The Oregon School for the Blind had a board meeting last Thursday. And the next meeting of the Oregon School for the Deaf is March 7th. So I have email contacted folks, and mm-hmm. I have met Mr. Dorman today and had conversations in that regard. In that way.
Oh, great.
Madam Chair, one other thing I think we should just get on the record before we go. We did receive some inquiries from individuals on, I believe, both the boards for the School for the Deaf and School for the Blind about what our appearance or being summoned before Ways and Means over the last week or so. We've had two appearances, and we had some questions about, what does that mean for the boards and appeal rights and stuff, and we have subsequently re-clarified to both the boards that the Ways and Means Committee presentations were informational in nature, responding to legislative direction and a budget note, and that we hope that's been clarified for the board members as well, too. So we've sent a letter sort of restating what the January 9th letter said to all of the board members electronically. So.
Mr. Allen, were the boards given an opportunity to appear before Ways and Means?
Chair Walker, I do not believe that the boards were invited by the Ways and Means Committee to appear before the board.
Okay.
Before the committee.
All right. Any questions, Senator Cruz?
No.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both for coming, and thank you, Mr. Allen, for sticking with it and being there to answer all of my very direct questions. It's appreciated. All right. Any other persons wishing to testify about this issue? I don't see anyone. But I'm glad we are moving along. I see a few issues here I'm going to be thinking about, but I like the direction and the tenor of the conversation so far. So welcome aboard, Ms. Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on the Schools for the Blind and the School for the Deaf, and I believe that takes care of everything. I will alert the committee, of which there is only two now, that we may be meeting on Thursday as well, because we have a little bill relating to education that may be used for a couple of things. So if we can't get that taken care of in time, we may. I've had a conversation with at least one part of my leadership, so I'm just letting the audience know that tomorrow may not be the last stand for this committee, but it might be. So we will see where that takes us. Thank you very much for joining us. We are adjourned.